Thank you, Chair. Thanks, everybody, for coming along. And I'm grateful to the Socialist Party for inviting me to speak and for inviting me to come along, as you said, to the sessions that we've already had over the course of this summer school. I've enjoyed it. I've enjoyed it a lot. I've agreed with a lot of what I've heard. Some of it I'll have to think about. Some of it maybe not quite. But let's be honest, that's the best you're ever going to get. Because we do know that Marxists don't always agree. And what I'm hoping to do in my talk today is just to say, accepting that that's inevitable, accepting that, in fact, there are going to be disagreements, there are going to be arguments, there's going to be a diversity of views among people who are trying to get to the stateless and classless society that we all want to get to. That those disagreements are not just an inevitable trouble that we should glumly put up with, but that we should be realistic, demand the inevitable, and we should accept that it's a good thing. That the existence of pluralism of a range of views, range of opinions, is positively to be desired. Might not apply quite to all the opinions I've heard over the course of the weekend so far, but a lot of them. So an idea that's been mooted in one or two of the earlier sessions is scientific socialism. I think one of the comrades asked in the last session, what is the distinction between the socialism of Marx and Engels and utopian socialism? And I suppose the canonical, very orthodox answer that Marx or Engels would have offered is that they want to make socialism a science, that they want to do socialism scientifically. And one or two allusions to that idea have already been made. But maybe that idea is harder to understand than it would otherwise be because of a peculiarity of the way we use words in English. Marx and Engels, for good or for ill, were not native speakers of English. They were having these conversations in German. And in German, the word that's translated science does not line up quite exactly with the English word science. If you hear the English word science, you think physics, chemistry. You think something that you do in a lab coat. Whereas in German, where the word is Wissenschaft, history is a science in German. It's a Wissenschaft. Law is a science. If you said, I'm off to university to study science, then it might be history, it might be law. What we're talking about now, talking about the difference between German and English, is we call it in English linguistics. They call it Sprachwissenschaft, speech science or language science. Art history is a science in German. So let's think about art history for a moment. To clarify what we might mean by a science. People quite often say, don't they, I don't know much about art, but I know what I like. I like that picture and I don't like that one. And if you ask them, well, why did you like that picture? Why do you want that up on your wall and you wouldn't have that one? Then they might be able to say something like, well, it's got orange, and orange is my favorite color. Or they might say it's a portrait, and I admire the person it's a portrait of. One of the earlier speakers was talking about putting up portraits of Marx and Engels. And that wouldn't be primarily for the artistic value, because I admire the person it's a portrait of. Or I like this picture because it reminds me of a place I've been on holiday. Or they might say, well, I can't tell you really what I like about it. I just think it looks beautiful, or it looks exciting, or it looks dramatic, or it looks restful, or whatever it is. And the conversation sort of ends there, because if I don't much like the color orange, and I like blue better, then we can't have a useful conversation about whether blue or orange is a better color. Whereas if you've studied art history, then you would have learned, and perhaps if you're interested, you might think, well, why does this picture look beautiful to me and that one not? Why does this pattern appeal to me more than the other? And you might study art history and learn about different techniques and perspective and line and color and form, and learn to be able to discuss in a somewhat objective way. And then if you say, well, this has simple perspective in this picture, all the vanishing points go back to a single point or something like that. Well, then if you're wrong, somebody can say, no, you're wrong, it doesn't do that. Look, let's measure it. And it's possible to be objective, it's possible to be rigorous, it's possible to have a useful disagreement or a useful discussion, because you're approaching that work of art scientifically. You might also, incidentally, in a capitalist society, you just might be able to make a lot of money identifying forgeries and picking out real old masters, but we'll not concentrate on that. But I think what that illustrates is that to do something scientifically means to do it rigorously, with clearly stated criteria. Well, rather than just saying, I like it or I don't like it, you try to understand what it is and how it works, and you can then discuss that with other people, debate that with other people, and they might be able to correct your views, and you end up appreciating it in more detail. And maybe you end up not liking so much the picture that you initially liked, because you realize that some of what you liked in it was actually very easy tricks. And you might learn that the picture that you didn't originally like, maybe there's more going on than at first you thought. Well, similarly with society, I think. A lot of people would say, I don't know much about capitalism, but I know what I don't like. I don't like poverty. I don't like manifest inequality. I don't like war, and so on. And so they are thinking critically. They are against the present order of society, but they're not yet thinking scientifically about it, because those thoughts are not formed in a way where they are reasoned, where they're rigorous, where they're based on trying to understand how capitalist society works and how it might be overcome, which I take it is at least what Marx and Engels are setting out to do, and what they would regard as what's new and different in their socialism compared to a lot of what's gone before. And as with the art history example, you might then find that once you've studied it in more detail, initially you thought, well, what I really hate about it is low wages. But if you study it in a bit more detail, you find out that actually it's the existence of wages at all that's the root of the problem. So if we're trying to do socialism scientifically, then that can't just be a matter of laying down the law and it's my way or the highway. There has to be scope, because from the way I've sketched out what a science might be, it's pretty intrinsic to the fact that that you're doing something scientifically is that you're doing it in a reasoned way, that it's open potentially to criticism, that somebody who's got a better understanding of something can try to argue, can try to argue against you. And maybe you'll be bad-tempered about it and you won't take their criticism on board. But in principle, other people who are listening might think, oh, actually, that's a sound criticism. And that's how any science develops, whether it's... I mean, the details are different. Chemistry and art history are not exactly the same science, and socialism is different again. So the details are different in each case. But with any of them, science relies on the possibility of debate, of different opinions, of a variety of possible analyses being put forward, and we can argue it out between them. And sometimes we can't immediately come to a conclusion. Where I suppose socialism differs from art history and from some of those other activities is that we're also trying to be, or Marxists are trying to be, a political movement. And we don't just analyze and understand how society works, but we're also hoping to change it, or to be involved in changing it, or to be part of the process of changing it. And that, again, means that there's space for pluralism. People are going to have different ideas, different tactical ideas, different strategic ideas, and some of those might have been touched on in earlier discussions over the course of yesterday and today. And as far as possible, we want to be able to deal with those things democratically. And democracy, again, just as science relies on debate and on the possibility of different ideas to correct the mistakes and so on. Democracy as well is pretty inconceivable without the possibility of different opinions, different ideas being put forward. Again, that's something that was alluded to in one of the sessions we've already had, that part of the value of democracy is that it allows different ideas, it allows different opinions to be put forward. And I think that's true among Marxists as well. And within an organization, it might be necessary. Okay, we're not all convinced yet, but for the time being, we'll go with what the majority says, because what else are we going to go with? And I think that phenomenon of differences of opinion and democratic ways of resolving them, at least provisionally, will continue to be true in the classless and stateless society. People occasionally say, oh, well, it wouldn't really have democracy because democracy is a kind of state. But that I don't find very persuasive, because we happily talk about an organization that is not the state, whether it's a political party, whether it's a trade union, whether it's all kinds of things, being run in a more or less democratic way without implying that it's got a coercive military force and the other attributes of the state. So I think issues will continue to come up where different opinions will exist. And I'll give you a very straightforward example. We're here in Worcester. There's no direct train from Worcester to Stratford-upon-Avon. Now, as it happens, when I was coming up here yesterday, it felt as though there were no direct trains to Worcester from anywhere. But there's never a direct train to Stratford-upon-Avon. So a journey that takes 40, 45 minutes by driving takes you 2 hours on the train. You have to go all the way into Birmingham and out again. And that would continue to be an annoyance in the socialist or communist future. And people might reasonably say, well, we'd quite like to be able to go on the train and see a play at the stateless and classless Shakespeare Company and come back easily the same evening and not have it take us 2 hours each way. So an idea might be proposed. Let's build a railway line between Worcester and Stratford. And then there could be various possible routes. And let's say one of them involves bulldozing through the habitat of an endangered species, a rare spider or whatever it might be. And another one goes through a site of natural beauty that people enjoy going to look at the view. And a third one, let's make it interesting, goes through a location that's of importance in revolutionary history. It might even be this very conference center, the site of the historic 2025 SPGB Summer School. And if we're going to build this railway, then it's going to damage one of those three things. Well, I don't think it's good enough to say people will just do what seems best to them, whatever comes into your head. You know, if you think it's best to knock down the spiders, then go and knock down the spiders. Well, you might find that all three of them get started. You might find we end up with three complete railways, which nobody wants. And the people who don't want to demolish the important revolutionary location don't just want not to do it themselves, but they want it not to be done. So I think, and with that, I don't think there is any immediately obviously right answer. Even if we pass a mandate forward saying we don't mind, you know, save the spiders, we'd have done it in another hall if we'd been in another hall. We're not so bothered about bricks and mortar. We can't, you know, cookshops of the future, we can't give them instructions. So I don't think there's an obviously right, clearly correct Marxist position on a question like that one. And questions of that kind will continue to arise. And people will just have different opinions. People sometimes, I think, imagine that the classless society would be an immediately transparent society where the answer to any question that comes up is obvious. And so everybody agrees. And that idea was still used, incidentally. You find defenses of the democratic character of the Soviet Union well into the depths of Stalinism. You find people saying, well, yeah, of course, all the votes are unanimous. You know, they all vote the same way. But that's because they no longer have class antagonism, so it's the... It's transparent. Everybody does just agree. Everybody sees what the right answer is, and they all agree we'll do what the leadership said. Well, we know perfectly well why everybody voted unanimously under those circumstances. But I think that's really the only way you get consistent unanimity. Because on lots of issues like that with the railway, maybe we don't need a railway at all. How much of a bother really is it? Or we could put on a bus to Stratford. Why do we need a railway? So there would be, and that's a simple example. And hopefully an example that doesn't stir the passions too violently. But examples of that nature would continue to come up all the time where there is not one unequivocal right answer. And people would just disagree. Some people would prioritize one thing more, and some people would prioritize another thing more. And that would be based on different opinions. And I think it's much more plausible that a society without class antagonism would be one where there was a great flourishing of diversity of opinions. If you want the immediately transparent society where it's unequivocally obvious what the right answer is, then I would recommend capitalism, because pounds and pence are a pretty effective universal measure under capitalism, whether you're talking about railway routes or whether you're talking about works of art or whether you're talking about any other question. Then a capitalist system, the most profitable one is the best one. Let's do that. And never mind about the spiders and never mind about anything else. Whereas in a socialist society where people were not compelled to follow the diktat of profit and loss, there would be scope for an enormous variety, I think. Enormous variety of different opinions. And you would get just as much argument, perhaps a lot more argument. It wouldn't have the same nature of being antagonistic class division that we see in current society. But on all kinds of questions, ethical questions, aesthetic questions, a wide variety of others. I say ethical questions. I mean, I don't know what the moral consensus of socialist society will be about vegetarianism, for example. In the classless future, everybody will eat meat, and they will think that vegetarianism is some ancient exploded bit of asceticism, like saints who used to live on pillars, and we don't do any of that now. Maybe nobody will eat meat, and the consensus will be a vegan consensus, and it will be a bit of a barrier in the same way that however much you admire a writer or a thinker from ancient Greece, there's a bit of a barrier always that they had slaves. And it might be a bit of a barrier that even Marx and Engels, you know, they were carnivores. Either of those things could be true. I could also easily believe that you would have a diversity of views on that subject. It's not only in capitalism that you have people who eat meat and people who don't, but in ancient society as well. You had some people who were vegetarian, who thought it was wrong to eat animals, and you had other people who thought it was fine. And you had arguments between them. So that's an example of the kind of things. And I think that's a fruitful. We not only do not want the kind of society that Stalin's USSR actually was, but I don't think we really want the society that it pretended to be, which was one where everybody just unanimously puts their hand in the air because there isn't any debate, because there doesn't need to be any debate. That's not why they put their hands in the air in the Soviet Union in the 1930s. But even if it had been, I don't think that's what we want. I think we should welcome the idea of pluralism, of a wide range of opinions, including some wrong-headed opinions, including some opinions that we'll think, oh, come on. Either because they're pedantic or because... And I don't want to obsessively quote from William Morris' News from Nowhere, which is one vision of some aspects of how socialism might look. And I don't want to take that as a dogmatic blueprint any more than anybody else's vision. But in that book, he includes a grumbler who thinks that probably capitalism was quite good and it might have been exciting to live in a capitalist society. And we're not meant to think very highly of the grumbler. But he's free to go about his business. He's free to argue his position. And people might say, oh, God, here he goes again. But that I think is absolutely right. If people want, in the classless future, to argue, wouldn't it be good to bring private property and class oppression, exploitation back, then absolutely they should be free to argue it. I don't think they should or would be able to do it in the same way that in capitalist society now. If I said, you know what, you lot, we said I'm the speaker and you're the audience, but actually it's slightly different. The way we're actually going to work it is I'm the lord of the manor now and you're the serfs. And you've got to work for me like feudal serfs, and a certain percentage of everything that you produce comes to me, and you've got to mill your grain in my mill. It might be, in fact, that if I attempted to enforce that, I would be breaking the law. I might be committing a criminal offense under laws that are designed to cover what's called modern slavery. But even disregarding that, even assuming that I'm not breaking any specific law, no such claim as the one I'd be making on you could be enforced, because no institution in mature capitalist society recognizes the status of serf. And if I went to the police or went to anybody else and said, my serfs have run away, why won't my serfs do what they're supposed to do? Then at best, they would laugh at me and say, come on, it's not the 14th century, mate. You haven't got any serfs. And that would be like somebody in the socialist society of the future trying to set up as a capitalist. There's no institutional framework for it. You can't sign a contract for employment. What would you be paying them with? Nothing like that exists. You can, if you want, argue for it. In the same way that if I wanted, I could go and give out leaflets in the street corner saying they should let me be the landlord, lord of the manor, and they should let people be my serfs. I doubt very many people would be up for it. I mean, I hope they wouldn't. But we should be glad that arguing for it is permitted, even though the institution isn't. Because that's exactly the same. The rule that means I can hand out leaflets arguing for serfdom is precisely the same as the rules that say that I can hand out leaflets arguing for socialism or for any other fundamentally different economic system. So I don't know whether there will be very many grumblers in the communist or socialist future. But I wouldn't be surprised if there are one or two, and up to a point, good luck to them. That's part of the pluralist. That's part of the pluralist tapestry as well. And I suppose that then that's all talking about the future society that we're trying to create. But I think the same goes for us now, that the existence of a variety of views, before the word dialectic was taken up by Hegel and others with a more advanced philosophical meaning, dialectic was used to mean dialogue or to mean something like conversation or to mean an approach towards the right answer by an interplay backwards and forwards, a clash of different views. And although we may also use the other sense of dialectic, but I think there's something to be said for that one as well, that we should want, we should expect that it's a better, we'll get closer to the right answers if our views are tested in debate and in discussion between, and I'm talking about pluralism among Marxists or among scientific socialists or whatever terminology you prefer. Now, of course, having said all of that, and I'm winding down. Having said that, it would be hypocritical if I didn't leave plenty of time in the discussion and give you plenty of opportunity to argue against me. You are also allowed to argue for me. You're allowed to agree with what I've said. That can be part of it. But if those who don't agree, one of the advantages of being a pluralist is that people who argue the other side, I can just beam and say, even dogmatism is one strand in the rich pluralist tapestry. So it's something that we can continue to value. And I think I will stop there and take some questions or comments. Thank you.